Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One might think that with the trillions of megapixels being caught on digital cameras, there'll be no shortage of great nature photography in the years ahead. And yet, even with all the advantages of the digital revolution, Jeff Mitchum still shoots with film. It's the way he learned, and it's the way he loves to shoot. We continue our discussion with world-class nature photographer Jeff Mitchum when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Jeff Mitchum has spent most of his life looking for the beauty and the splendor that he peers through a viewfinder and pushes his finger, and, well, there's a lot more to good photography than that. Jeff continues to talk about his adventures in stalking the wild wonder.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people would find it interesting when they look at your website, and I'm sure many people already are, they're going to see that you've really traveled many, many, many places, I mean, all over the world, mm-hmm. and taken some extraordinary shots. Talk a little bit about how you approach this portfolio, because it is everything from spectacular close-up images of wildlife as well as grand landscapes, but then as well place. And I'm just curious how you kind of approach those different realms from your professional perspective.
Well, there's a couple of things, you know, again, that business side, if I could start with that. You know, sometimes there's an image that you come across and you know that you have a market for it. And also you know that is going to be a good market for that particular image, and that when the public sees it, they're going to get involved, or they're going to be more conscious when they come into that area, keeping it clean, keeping it pristine, restoring it, protecting it. So there's a little bit of a mixed marriage there. You know, the business side, does somebody really want to purchase this image? Is there a need for it? And then sometimes, you know, the other part is, you know, its value to the world. So there's the business side. But when I generally approach, though, for the most part, 90% of the time, that's just the other 10% sometimes clicks in the back of my brain, I'll come upon a scene. And I look at it, and I study it. Other times you've seen other people have taken that image, and you look at it and you study it some more. And then I start thinking, how can I photograph this differently? Or has it really been captured in its essence? There's a place when you go on the website, in fact, it's under my new releases, and I've been working in this area in Big Sur, maybe the most photographed place in the world outside of Yosemite. And it gets a lot of good photography, and there's and the guys that live there, I think of Brock Bradford at the Big Sur River Inn, and he's but he lives there. That's his backyard. You cannot compete with those guys. It's a done deal. I mean, they live there. You know, they see all the changes, and it's 7 hours north for me. I can't get there when I would want to be there. So, and generally, I'm in another place of the world, anyways, but. You know, sometimes I'll see some of the things that he has done, you know, and I'll look at it and I'll study it, and then I want to know, how could I shoot it and what would be different? So even though this is his backyard, I have what is really unique and special. And when you go to the new releases, you'll see an image, and it's called Under the Moonlight. I did this 3-hour exposure at an F11 with this lagoon, waterfall, the ocean, the seascape, and sensational. Just a beautiful image and unique. So, you know, I walked out of there with a diamond in the rough that, you know, nobody's really captured that before. And, you know, I kind of carried that same theme down into Pfeiffer and same area. And, you know, just thinking, you know, just sitting and then shooting it throughout the year. Different times of the year, different lighting, different angles of that light. So you have to be very religious in, you know, approaching an image like that, that, you know, or any image, and just thinking, you know, how can I approach? And, you know, probably then, you know, the key to photography at that junction and great photography is anticipation. You know, seeing it in your mind beforehand and being prepared to capture it. And that means weather conditions, reading the lighting, color shifts, the landscape, the composition, all of that has to be done, should be done well in advance. You just don't stumble across great photos. You know, Ansel Adams stumbled across one in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and as we know, that famous photo that he has. But that's, you know, those things happen, but not rarely.
It's obvious to me when I look at your work that you've spent real time. You can't just be driving along, maybe once in a while. Once in a while, you may get lucky, okay. Mm-hmm. But literally, in terms of, let's say, U.S. landscapes, do you travel back roads? How do you find the off-road places? Do you spend time literally hiking, walking around?
Yeah. And, you know, what you do is, you know, you get up and you have your early morning subjects that you want to work with, and perhaps the day before you laid out that early morning shot. Again, you're anticipating, you're looking at the direction of the sun, where it's going to come up, how is the lighting going to affect, what time of day that you want to be there. And so a lot of your homework is done the day before, and then you arrive, you shoot that location, and typically, you know, noon and, you know, the afternoon hours, the sun is so harsh that that's an ideal time to scout. And so here's your chance to organize your film bag and, you know, clean camera equipment. But that's when I start hiking. I'll do a lot of back road driving and, you know, investigating, looking, walking down canyons, and, you know, and staying disciplined too, that you can never go over enough ridges. You know, just keep going and looking and looking and looking. And another point that I would say that needs to be adhered to is not only the, you know, the hiking, but being very, very disciplined in, you know, the realm of your fitness. And do not settle for photographs taken out of the car. You know, there's the locations, obviously, it's, you know, I think of Oxbow Bend. I mean, you drive right to it in the Tetons, and the Snake River. I mean, you drive right there, and, you know, the Moran, you know, Junction, and a lot of those places, but don't let that dictate the style of photography that you, if you're going to be a nature landscape photographer, you got to get out, you got to hike, you got to get up on different angles and get higher, lower, sideways, get wet, you know, whatever it takes. Get out and have fun.
Well, I get the sense that's a huge part of why you do this. I kind of imagine you literally working out of base camps and tents and backpacks and different things like that, as opposed to, as you say, the people who go to a hotel and drive out and come back and party or something like that. You know, and that can be a side of it too. But yeah, what's the mix there?
Well, I like hotels. It wasn't like that early, but I was starving. And but no, I mean, diversity, you know, keeping a balance, moderation. There's a time for hotels, Alaska in the wintertime, hotels. Alaska in, you know, the spring and, you know, midsummer with the bugs. You know, dealing with that, and, you know, it's that's a nightmare, and, you know, you want protection. Africa and the Serengeti, and, you know, you just don't want to be out in a tent with, you know, dealing with those big, you know, large predators, the food chain, which you're a part of now. So, but, you know, I think you have to, you know, make the connection and, you know, be willing to sweat and, you know, to sleep under the stars, and, you know, that's what it's about. And so you can go minimalist, and I think for people that are on the budget, that's the great thing about camping, is that you're saving money, which means you can put that into another trip and go out and, you know, hit the trips that you want and, you know, get after it. You know, I hear a lot of people say that they can't afford going on trips and they're staying at 5-star hotels. I'm thinking, you know, that's a safari. You know, so go to, you know, a more of a lower budget or something, but, you know, you can do it.
We've kind of been focusing on the landscape, but now let's move into the realm of your animal photography, which is really extraordinary. You really go out and find these amazing creatures. I'm sure you can tell us. Once in a while, I get lucky, but most of it is a lot of patient hard work.
Yeah, and we were talking earlier about one of the grizzlies that, you know, I captured, and, you know, following them for 3 days and through this high grass, and then finally anticipating that he was going to get up on his hind legs as soon as something piqued his interest. and sitting behind that big lens and following him day in and day out, waiting just for that one photo. But what makes that image happen, it's so special, is anticipation. Knowing his behavior, knowing that when something loud or a change in his environment gets through into his ears and just hearing isn't going to be enough, he's going to want to have visual contact. Then I know that he's an 8-foot grass. He's going to have to get on his hind legs, which means that now I've got the frame of that beautiful sweeping green grass and the browns, and the light was right on him, and that's what made that photo so special.
When you're photographing wildlife, talk a little bit about the mix between the lens versus getting close.
There is, and you know, the speed in which you have to shoot sometimes is really important. Grizzlies, you can get away with shooting, you know, at a slower speed because they tend to move slower. Birds are going to be a faster, you know, moving subject. What that means is that a shorter lens is going to move a lot quicker, and longer lens is going to move. So there's give and take, I think, all the time. You know, a longer lens allows you to crop in tighter, to follow them at a distance so that they're not getting stressed out, which is really important, working with wildlife, that we don't change their behavior so that we can get a photo. Closer is better. If you can work with shorter lenses, then you can get away from the tripod, ramp up the, you know, shutter speed on it, and you're going to get sharper images. But then you also have to make sure that you're not crossing that line, you know, where they're uncomfortable with you. And, you know, animals habituate differently. You know, every animal is different. Some grizzlies I'll work with exclusively with long lenses because they're dangerous. They are an absolute dangerous animal. That particular personality of that particular bear, you can just see they're very agitated. Rarely do you ever see at all. I've never seen anyone working with interior grizzlies up close. Never. All those close-up shots of those big bears are on the coast. They have plenty of food. They're not stressed. They're very familiar with their environment, and you can work very, very tight with them with a short lens.
Talk about some of the experiences that you've had shooting various forms of wildlife.
Well, you have, there's another image that's in my web portfolio. It's a grizzly in a waterfall, very popular place, you know, in Brooks. And I actually had hiked up into a little bit of a higher area to get away from people, and I was looking for some different angles and didn't want to be bothered by the rangers. So I'm up working in this one area. And the grizzlies will not turn their backs on one another. So if you have another big male competing for the fishing grounds that one is fishing in, then what happens is that the dominant male will push out the other grizzlies to other locations in that area to fish. And so this one big male had come in, and his name is BB, and he was notorious. He actually has killed several grizzlies. He's like, you know, the Mike Tyson of bear world. And he walks into the river, and the one grizzly that I was working with doesn't turn his back, but he starts backing away, and I'm sitting on the river's edge. He keeps backing away. I've got a grizzly on my left. I got one on my right, and I have nowhere to go, and I'm stuck. And this grizzly doesn't even look back, and as he's walking out, I'm sitting right on the river's edge. He puts his back paw, now he's just within feet, and then he puts that back paw, he puts it right on my foot, rolls over it with that big pad of his. It's soft, you know, it didn't hurt my foot, but the fact is he's touching me now. He looks back, and not wanting to turn his back on BB, gives me a little grunt, and then turns sideways and walks down river. So that's one of my favorite stories. I came out alive, and you know, the bear was okay. And but that's what happens when you work with short lenses. You know, not a lot of room for error there, you know.
Since you spend so much time literally watching all sorts of different animals, what are you learning about them?
Well, that when you move slow, and that when you're very respectful of their environment, you introduce yourself to their environment, and you know, you sit still, They're very tolerant of people, extremely tolerant of people. It's sudden movements that really, you know, move them. You know, I think there's a balance. I mean, I know that there has been, you know, an attempt to introduce people into the animal, you know, kingdom and make this as, you know, a part of their, you know, their evolution. But there is so many noticeable differences that, you know, the more that you study and you watch them, you realize here is, and this might be an entirely unpopular thing to say, but by my personal observation, that unlike humans, that rarely, but they do show a true stick love. They do share the ability to share, charitable. They're, you know, humans are provoked to be giving and loving and kind. The animal kingdom is very, very selfish, very independent. It's me and no one else. The only thing they care about outside of their offspring is their own independent survival. You never see a bear providing, you know, killing something and then feeding, you know, coyotes or foxes and vice versa. They're always in a constant state of being agitated because they have to. That's the way that they stay alive. An unalert lion or an unalert leopard, that's a dead one. They don't live very long. They have a lot of opportunist type of, you know, decisions that they'll make. If you go in and you watch animals and, you know, in Africa, you know, they're all constant. Those ears are moving, their eyes are twitching, their necks are turning around, and there's only one reason why: who's coming to kill me? And so that's it's a different way to look at, you know, not that it causes us not to love them any less, but it does help us to help them. And we don't want to change their environment and start gobbling up more space or doing things like that that endangers them. And so we have to be very careful in the way that we work with them, and then also, you know, keeping a respectful distance, you know, at the same time.
What animals are your favorite to photograph?
Boy, I love them all. I've taken a real active interest in just breaking down and, you know, any chance that I have around the house, grabbing lizards, you know, so that I can introduce my children into, you know, their world and, you know, studying them. You know, we have this gecko that showed up in our home, and it's acclimated for Hawaii, but here it is in Southern California, and you know, he lives in our home, and, you know, and I think it's one of the coolest things to have gecko droppings in our couch, you know. I have to vacuum more than I used to. You know, it's such a fascinating animal that it was even used during biblical times as examples that Solomon noticed them. And if you read some of what Solomon wrote about geckos hanging out in the king's palace, and then he made the analogy and the allegory that by their ability to hang on their backs, literally, by the little suction cups on their paws, that they have royalty. They hang out in royal places just because they hang in there. And that's Solomon's point, is they hang in there, and, you know, and then he passes on that little bit of wisdom. You know, if you hang in there long enough, you'll see the changes, you'll see the moving of the guards, you'll see the royalty come in and out, and you know, and the whole time he's up there, he's unnoticed. And so those are things that, you know, I find so, you know, fascinating. There's so much to an animal. Like, you know, they literally have thousands of little microscopic suction cups, like Spider-Man, on their fingertips. Thousands of them, you know, and that's why they can walk on glass upside down. It's amazing to me, you know, and I just, like, can you find a more interesting animal when you start breaking down an animal like that and studying it? And, you know, bears, you know, when they have their offspring, you know, they give birth to the smallest mammal. They're the largest mammal that gives birth to the smallest one, and land mammals. And, you know, they're, you know, coming out at, you know, they're like, you know, 4 and 5 ounces. You can't hardly see them. And yet then they grow into these 1,200-pound carnivores. And that to me is, you know, when they're done eating and feeding, and it's a great time to start taking notes and, you know, learning about them, and it personalizes them. So love the bears. It's hard to pick a favorite. It just depends where they're at, what they're doing, and there's so much to unravel out there.
How long have you actually been photographing it professionally?
Boy, I got to do my age here. 47. And then going back to 24. So what's 23 years. Yeah.
That's important because there are changes happening on the planet, particularly in the wild and the open spaces. Mm-hmm. And you've been out there witnessing this. And sometimes it's hard to notice changes when you're right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
But you have actually had a chance to potentially see some of the changes that people are talking about. I'd really love to hear what your perceptions are, because you look, you watch, you're very conscious of the changes, whether it's in Africa or in Alaska or in Wyoming. I'm just curious what you're observing.
And we'll find out when we continue our in-depth journey with nature photographer extraordinaire Jeff Mitchum, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.